From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. A potential change to federal funding requirements by the Trump administration could put nearly 1,000 formerly homeless people in Nevada at risk of losing their permanent housing. That's according to analysis by the National Alliance to End Homelessness. That's because U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced last month new restrictions to Continuum of Care program funding, which is the largest block of federal funding states rely on to address homelessness. The rule said no more than 30% of federal grants received through the program can go toward funding permanent housing. Nevada uses an estimated $13 million in funding annually to house about 925 people. Earlier this week, the administration reversed its decision, rescinding the rule. Despite that sudden reversal, some officials and advocates around the state are worried about how the potential change could set back local efforts to curb homelessness. Alejo Cruz from our sister station KUNR Reno has this report.
The slide in front of you represents a study that was made.
On a Tuesday morning in mid-November, Maurice Page addressed Washoe County commissioners during one of their regular meetings. Page is executive director of the Nevada Housing Alliance. He was there to give an update on the state of affordable housing, but he also warned them of a pending change at the federal level, one that's expected to radically alter funding for homeless services.
In Washoe County, you stand to lose $1.9 million, which will result in about 88 households losing rental assistance and support services.
Page was talking about new guidance from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. The agency sends billions to local governments and nonprofits tasked with addressing homelessness.
All of those households were previously homeless and now will likely return to homelessness if no alternative funding is provided.
The Trump administration is selling the new policy as a way to address what it calls the root causes of homelessness, severe mental illness and substance abuse. On November 14th, HUD announced it would change its grant-making process that could defund programs that get unhoused people into permanent housing in favor of street outreach and involuntary commitment. But advocates and local officials say the change could undo the progress that has been made, even as the trends driving more and more Americans into the street continue.
We've made a tremendous amount of progress here locally, and one of the ways we've been able to make that progress is through these HUD programs.
Katrina Peters is Homeless Services Coordinator for Washoe County. She says local officials and their nonprofit partners have been getting people into permanent housing as quickly as they can, but rising costs are driving more and more of them out of it. That churn means the overall number of unhoused people has stayed about the same. Peters isn't satisfied with the status quo, but she says the new HUD priorities threaten to make things even worse.
All those folks who are currently housed, if that funding is not renewed, are likely going to be facing homelessness.
Meanwhile, local homeless services are in decline for other reasons too. For almost 5 years, the Reno Municipal Court hosted a special program called Community Court. It was meant to guide unhoused people away from jail and into services. Officials held hearings for low-level offenses in the downtown Reno library. Outside the hearing room, government agencies and nonprofits gathered to help unhoused defendants with services and support. But in October, court officials told KUNR the program struggled with low success rate, and that service providers were dropping out.
Sometimes people fall off the truck and they gotta get back on.
Joaquin Rosas is one of those service providers. He's a peer support counselor with Hope Springs, a transitional living facility. Rosas fears that losing access to Community Court and its network will only make it harder for people to get off the street. So does Hope Springs resident, Dean Herman.
And that's what the people need. They need a roof over their head. They need, you know, place to lay down. And then you can change your mindset.
Herman was first connected to Hope Springs at Community Court, where he was sent after being cited for camping and having an open container. He attributes much of his success to the resources Community Court connected him to.
A lot of those people aren't going to go to the real court. They're going to still be out on the streets, and they're just going to start scooping people up and throwing them in jail.
Herman says without that support, people like him will continue to suffer. Alejo Cruz, KUNR News.
Now joining me to dive a little deeper into his reporting is Alejo Cruz. Also with us is Bert Johnson. He's KUNR's senior correspondent and helped co-report this piece with Alejo. Guys, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
First, let's talk about where this money comes from, Alejo. How are local governments supposed to use these continuum of care dollars? You know, what are they supposed to use it for?
So continuum of cares have to adhere to kind of HUD guidelines when it comes to applying to these grants. And currently, as it stands, or the way in which we knew about this process beforehand was that, you know, they prioritize housing first models. And so when they're trying to initiate these programs or using rental assistance, they have to ensure to HUD that they're using it for housing first models. That, however, as we know, is subject to change.
So what kind of person is eligible for permanent housing assistance?
Yeah, so here we're talking about like low income renters, right? It's not as if they're just kind of like passing out housing vouchers to whoever. It's typically people that make around like 50 to 30% below the medium like pay. Mm-hmm. And those with disabilities, veterans, but then also the chronically homeless.
Okay. So this administration's approach to homelessness seems to be a significant departure from previous administrations' efforts to curb homelessness. You know, it seemed like previous administrations were very much focused on getting people into housing first, like you mentioned. You know, what is the Trump administration's goal here? You know, what are they trying to accomplish with this change?
Yeah, so it's difficult to kind of just surmise what the end goal of this might be. However, what we do know is that now we're stepping away from housing first and making it more of an individual failure is kind of the way homelessness is now being painted. Now it's sort of mental health and substance abuse seems to be what they've identified to be the root of the problem here, despite all evidence showing otherwise.
Bert, where does this ethos come from?
So this has its roots actually in Project 2025, which listeners may remember was sort of a playbook for a potential second Trump administration that was put together by the Heritage Foundation. Mm. Back in July, you saw an executive order come out of the Trump administration that kind of built on the original ideas from Project 2025. And in that executive order, President Trump explicitly said, we need to get rid of the housing first approach to homelessness. And we need to put a focus on things like requirements for addiction treatment, mental health treatment, including potentially involuntary commitment into inpatient medical facilities.
So let's talk about what communities are doing to prepare for a potential change. What are you hearing from them, Bert?
Essentially in Washoe County, at this point in the game, they're not 100% sure what to make of this. First of all, when these changes were announced by HUD last month, it was a sea change from how this funding had been allocated before. But the most recent update is that the HUD has withdrawn this newer guidance. So on Monday, there is going to be a hearing in a Rhode Island federal court over the new policy changes introduced by HUD. But right before the hearing could happen, the Trump administration walked back this guidance. Now, they've said they're going to release an update to the update, if you will. Mm-hmm. So they are planning to release another version of this. But for the time being, it's not clear what that's going to look like. And I've spent the week trying to reach out to advocates on the national level, trying to get a sense of what this could mean. And no one's really sure yet. So in some ways, it's just a wait and see, you know, because we were in the middle of a 2-year funding cycle already with continuum of care funding. And so it's possible that with HUD withdrawing this new guidance, it could just revert back to the status quo of that 2-year funding cycle, which is what was funding these programs like permanent supportive housing, rapid rehousing, et cetera. It's also possible that they put out another version of updated guidance before the end of the year. It's hard to say.
At this point, do we know if cities and counties can shift money around and actually shoulder the burden of these costs?
Oh, there's very little chance of that. Here in Washoe County, for instance, as we heard in Alejo's piece, the changes could result in like almost $2 million being taken out of the county's accounts. And that's just a shortfall that Washoe County wouldn't be able to shoulder on its own. I mean, local governments are already struggling with flattening revenue, increasing costs. We're already looking at budget cuts across the board on the local level. So a loss like this would be really significant.
What are you actually hearing from the people this might affect? Alejo, you talked to Dean Herman. Mm-hmm. He is somebody who's in transitional housing, was looking to get into permanent housing. You know, what are you hearing?
Yeah, so Dean and I had a very phenomenal conversation like throughout this piece, and it just sounds as if a lot of people are scared and they're worried about how they are going to be able to navigate the situation, but also like the likelihood of them falling back into homelessness also appears to have increased for them. You know, it's really, it's a slippery slope. Of something that I didn't get to mention in the piece itself was that while at Hope Springs, Dean was actually arrested for a warrant that he didn't even know he had, you know, and that almost made him put him right back to where he started. Luckily, fortunately, he wasn't, you know, didn't happen to him. But, you know, that's the reality for a lot of Nevadans that we're seeing.
We got about 30 seconds left, Bert. Community courts have been set up across the state to sort of, you know, address these sorts of issues, homelessness, veterans crime. It sounds like those community courts aren't necessarily having the impact that a lot of folks thought they would.
Yeah, that's true. We've talked to court officials who said that the success rate just wasn't there, that people, especially those who are experiencing chronic homelessness, were not engaging with services the way that they hoped they would. And I think that just speaks to the really difficult challenge of addressing that very small subset of this population, people who have been on the street for a year or more, who are really struggling to get back on their feet.
That's all the time we have. Bert Alejo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In the U.S., 40 states have legalized recreational marijuana. Half of them also have medical marijuana. Half of them also have recreational weed. Last week, much of the state's cannabis industry was in Las Vegas for its annual confab, the NJ Biz Conference. The industry has hit many speed bumps since the COVID-19 pandemic. Sales are generally down while the black market continues unabated. And the industry is still waiting for significant movement by the federal government to reschedule and eventually legalize cannabis nationally. But there have also been some victories. Last month, Congress effectively banned synthetic cannabis products that have eaten into sales of regulated marijuana. So how did 2025 go for Nevada's cannabis industry, and what might next year look like? Raina Durrett is the director of the Cannabis Policy Institute at UNLV and the vice chair of the state's Cannabis Compliance Board. Raina, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks, Paul.
You were at MJ Biz. First off, has this event been important to Nevada's cannabis industry?
I don't think it's been a pinnacle to Nevada's industry, but the industry nationally. And it has been a really big conference and brought people from all over the world. So I think we should be supportive of it in Nevada.
So the Institute presented a sold-out national policy symposium at the convention. What did you talk about? What was presented?
So we hosted a symposium at UNLV, actually, and we were taking advantage of a lot of people being in town for MJ Biz. But it was a policy symposium. We had top industry CEOs, thought leaders, people really active in cannabis policy, researchers, heads of trade associations. They all came together that day to talk about some of the top topics in cannabis.
You know, it's been said that President Trump is still pondering rescheduling. Cannabis remains a Schedule I drug and thus illegal on the federal level. Has there been any movement to change that this year?
You hear every couple weeks, it's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen tomorrow. I even get convinced. I just get caught up in people saying, my people talk to these people, and yes, it's going to happen. I, at this point, 10 years of fits and starts of we're almost to the gold at the end of the rainbow. My advice on my panel at MJ Biz was do a traditional SWOT analysis, run this like a regular business, and don't put all your hopes and dreams in big sweeping changes, because it just might not happen.
Somewhat related, one area of interest for you and the Institute is the relationship between cannabis and gaming. Currently, no legal cannabis operations are allowed within 1,500 feet of any facility with gaming, and casinos won't go anywhere near it with its current scheduling. Have you had any conversation with gaming industry folks this year? And maybe federal prohibition aside, how do they really feel about cannabis integration?
Yeah, actually, we are releasing a paper on that exact topic. I worked on it with an economist and a policy firm, Strategy 64, to really dig down into what are all the reasons for the separations. Who feels what? What could possibly change here? And what are the costs of the separations? And there are there are people backing off the separation that you'd be surprised. So we had a panel discussion with former Gaming Control Board member Terry Johnson, who actually wrote the initial letter in 2014 telling gaming stay away from cannabis. He, on that panel discussion, said, yeah, I think it's time to reassess. I thought he was going to be strictly stay away. It's federally legal. He said, no, let's have the conversation. We had a gaming executive there saying, gaming is struggling. We need all the tools in the toolbox. Let's look at how we can use this to boost our own businesses.
Do you get the sense that if it were rescheduled, that there'd be a sudden, you know, change of heart? You'd see just casinos or maybe operators suddenly be much more willing to get into the cannabis game?
Somewhat, because they need it. They're struggling. Some would, but I don't think things would change overnight. There would certainly be deliberative processes, there'd be workshops, there'd be legislation, there'd be a lot of, well, who does what, which licenses do what, how do we all work together? That's a lot of what our report looks at, is starting to look at, well, if things change, we've kind of backed ourselves into this corner. So how do we get ourselves out of this corner, and what would be the best way forward?
Rhianne Durrett is the director of the Cannabis Policy Institute at UNLV and the vice chair of the state's Cannabis Compliance Board. She's also a former executive director of the Nevada Cannabis Association. The person now holding that title is Lake Martin, who is also adjunct faculty at UNLV School of Public Policy and Leadership. Lake, welcome back.
Good morning.
You talk to a lot of Nevada cannabis professionals. You know, anecdotally, how did 2025 go?
So it's been pretty bleak. As you mentioned at the beginning, sales are down $70 million from the prior year. And sales the prior year were down from the year before that. So we're continuing to see decline. We're seeing some consolidation among companies. We're seeing some contraction generally in the market. We're seeing cultivators closing their doors. And we're seeing not a lot of growth and not a lot of new investment in the industry.
Is that partially because of what happened last month? You know, the federal government closed a loophole in legislation regarding hemp products. The ones you can consume or smoke, that includes the controversial Delta 8 and Delta 10 products, which cannot have more than 0.4 milligrams of total THC. Those so-called intoxicating hemp products that were once legally sold in the tourist corridor are now illegal. The cannabis industry has been pushing for that for years. You know, what impact does that have on your members and organization?
That's a great summary of the changes federally, but I wanted to note that that doesn't go into effect until November 2026. So we still have a year where these products are still able to be sold, although I think we'll see many of those businesses winding down. That's also a year where there's likely to be a lot of lobbying from the hemp industry to try to either scale back that restriction or carve out for certain types of products. Yeah, intoxicating hemp has been an existential threat to the licensed cannabis industry. And they don't have the same regulation, they aren't tested in the same way, and they aren't taxed in the same way. So as a state, you know, we've been pushing as an industry for sure to try to have more restrictions and regulations on these products. And as a state, it's a huge deal for us too, because we're not collecting the same, you know, excise taxes on hemp products as we are with cannabis. And none of the hemp money is going to education in the same way that cannabis money is.
You know, we have still continued to see a black market for cannabis. Do you expect a black market for Delta 8 or Delta 10 products?
I would argue that it already is a black market, right? Like, it is not currently regulated, so I don't know how it gets more unregulated.
Gotcha. There's something else the industry has been pushing for, a rewrite of IRS code 280E that forbids deductions of businesses that sell Schedule 1 and 2 drugs. The NCA and three other cannabis advocacy groups recently signed onto an amicus brief for a federal tax court case. It argues that cannabis industries suffer a higher tax burden than many other businesses for this reason and endure costly and frequent IRS audit defenses. How are you arguing for an exemption to cannabis despite its current scheduling?
This would be a tremendous benefit for the industry. Our cannabis businesses, licensed legal cannabis businesses, paid a 50 to 70% effective tax rate because they can't deduct ordinary and necessary business expenses, can't deduct salaries, can't deduct rent, any of those that normal businesses can. And so the argument is that 280E applies to businesses within the meaning of Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. And so in 2023 and 2024, with the discussion about rescheduling, reports came out from HHS and from the Office of Legal Counsel saying that they were basically misclassified this entire time. And there are medical uses, and there is a low propensity for abuse and addiction. And so they should not be classified as Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. And so the legal argument is that they are marijuana is not within the meaning of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. And so 280E should not apply to marijuana.
Back in Nevada, the industry saw some success with it this year's legislative session, which addressed areas like taxation, regulations, product testing, inspections, a lot more. What were the legislative wins that were most that will most positively impact the state?
One of the areas that we're looking to see, that we're excited to see enforced is cracking down on some of those fake dispensaries that you mentioned on the Strip. As Rihanna mentioned, we are zoned off the Strip completely, but there is still plenty of demand from tourists for intoxicating products, for marijuana products. And fake dispensaries have stepped up to meet that demand. They're opening stores everywhere with, you know, hemp leaves on the front of their buildings and marketing to tourists. They're either selling non-intoxicating flower, but that looks like marijuana, or they are actually selling THCA flower that is intoxicating and intoxicating products because of the hemp loophole. So I think that AB 504, which passed last session, allows for more enforcement, allows going into those stores, testing the products, and holding those owners responsible for selling illegal products and unlicensed products.
Lake Martin is the director of the Nevada Cannabis Association, which helps develop and advocate for best practices in the cannabis industry. Now with us is Christopher Laporte, a cannabis consultant and hospitality expert. Christopher, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You were also at MJ Biz. Where is the national industry with consumption lounges right now? Are there cities where they're thriving?
At the moment, we're not seeing too much movement. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it is because of regulation that's been developed. Just doesn't quite give the entrepreneurs an opportunity to create something really special. One thing, though, our team in the very beginning, working with AB 341, our bill in Nevada is actually becoming kind of a gold standard in that we just recently talked to Massachusetts where they're saying, hey, we want to follow kind of what you're doing here by way of focusing more on the food and beverage side of things and the hospitality side of things and simply replacing alcohol with cannabis. And, you know, we talked about the hemp situation a little bit ago. It was a $10 billion market of hemp-derived beverages being sold in the United States. They are being sold in Total Wine and Spirits. They are being sold in bars in Minnesota. As long as we see lounges start to open up with a focus on, hey, let's give product to a market that's not your traditional cannabis consumer, and let's sell you just some really good food and beverage. And by the way, here's a cannabis-infused drink. I think you can see the industry get a lot more excited because now you have what we call an on-premise location that will actually allow for the dispensaries to find a whole new consumer base.
In April, the Strip-adjacent consumption lounge you helped open, Smoke and Mirrors at Thrive Dispensary, closed after only 14 months of operation. I'm curious, what happened?
It was just a smoking lounge. You know, and again, if we're going to look at the way the cannabis industry is currently running and operating, we're seeing cannabis sales slow down. Why is that? We're selling to the same consumers over and over again. We need to get creative. We need to get just a little more open-minded in terms of how to open up this market to new people. And again, it's why I really stress the beverage play. There's infused foods that we really haven't touched on. And again, there's more to cannabis than simply coming in to buying your weed for the week. We need to get introduced to cannabis via an experience, not just a dispensary. Let me ask the people who are listening how many times you bought your first glass of wine that you never had before by going to a store versus it was introduced to you at a restaurant. And so again, I think that unfortunately, Smoke and Mirrors did not reach its full potential by offering a full food and beverage restaurant experience. And, you know, a lot of other places throughout the country learned that same experience. If you're just going to sell to smokers, that's not a big enough market to succeed.
Let me ask you, are you still bullish on the cannabis industry as a whole?
It's the only reason why I'm here. You know, at the end of the day, the biggest challenge that we've had over the course of the past couple of years is just raising capital. And when you're trying to raise capital for something new and different, that makes it even harder. And the thing that's exciting about what other jurisdictions are doing, Massachusetts in particular, is that they're opening up a $50 million fund to allow license holders who can't have access to capital to create their vision. We have someone here in Las Vegas by the name of Tamara Smith. She has an amazing idea for a restaurant concept that will allow you to enjoy whatever you normally do in any of the other great restaurants in Las Vegas. And again, less people are drinking, more people looking for non-alcoholic options. Someone's always looking for a new experience. And I think that you could see that happen once capital is secured.
So what do you think happens next here in Nevada for the cannabis hospitality industry?
I think in 2026, we're going to see something finally open. And when it does, I think it's going to create a lot of excitement nationwide because Las Vegas knows hospitality. And when this product is done the right way and you're showcasing good food to come to, people go to restaurants because, oh, look at that. There's a cotton candy fondue I've never had before, or foie gras, sorry. You know, just bring them back for something that everybody likes and now introduce them. We talk a lot about education. Great, let's show them that low-dose cannabis beverages is a great replacement for an alcoholic beverage. No hangover in the morning. Additionally, again, if we start talking to a market that's not your traditional cannabis consumer, more people become our advocates. There's nothing more important than people who work in Las Vegas saying, hey, this is a great new experience that's only in Las Vegas. Let's try this out.
Lake, let me ask you, what is holding a business back from, say, offering cannabis-infused foods and beverages like Christopher's talking about? Are there regulations holding them back from offering these sort of services?
Well, yeah. I mean, there have been recent regulatory changes where we'll be able to soon sell more types of products, but those are more like snack-type products, not cannabis-infused prepared foods or anything like that. Those currently would have to go through a lounge.
Gotcha. I understand. So for you, for the Institute, what are you going to be working on and looking at in the year ahead?
Oh, gosh, we have some cool things coming up. We'll do our annual symposium. I mentioned that report that we're going to look at. One of the co-authors, like I said, is an economist. He went to Harvard, Yale, has a PhD in economics. And he said at our symposium, Nevada is the state that leaves the most amount of money on the table when it comes to legalized cannabis. When you look at when voters passed cannabis legalization in 2016, and a lot of it was about the tax revenue, we didn't say at the time, asterisk, we're going to only collect a fraction of the money we could because we're going to limit the opportunities for this licensed industry so much. But one other exciting thing off the top of my head, I'm teaching the first cannabis class related to tribes. That's another area of very exciting growth. It's called Cannabis and Industry Cannabis and Indian Country, and it's the first in the country. And we have so much coming up. There's a lot to list.
What about you, Lake? What's going on with the association next year?
I think we're going to see how this federal hemp restrictions pan out and what needs to change at the local level. The Cannabis Advisory Commission is working on two studies gearing up for the next legislative session, one on taxation. We have a two-step taxation where the wholesale transfer is taxed and the retail is taxed as well. Some states have moved to just taxing at retail. Some states have maintained the two, and whether that makes sense or whether changes should be made to the taxation structure. We're also looking at local and statewide hemp restrictions and regulations. Are we going to be able to just align with what's happening at the federal level? What is going to be happening at the federal level in a year? And do we need stricter enforcement at the local level? We also, we're still working on everything from illicit market and regulation and making sure that our regulations are streamlined, our operators are able to stay in business, and operate efficiently and safely. And so all of that is on the table for 2026. And continue to work with Rihanna and her team. I mean, she makes an excellent, excellent, important point about the 1,500-foot zoning and the impact it has on licensed cannabis businesses. We are leaving money on the table. We've sent $800 million in taxes to K-12 education. It could be more if we're able to reach all those customers we need to.
We're going to have to leave it there. Christopher Laporte is a cannabis consultant. Lake Martin is the executive director of the Nevada Cannabis Association. And Rihanna Durrett is the director of UNLV's Cannabis Policy Institute. All of you, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
The Las Vegas suburbs have become a hotbed of contemporary art. You heard that right. From the vast network of libraries that all host at least one gallery, to the hidden gems like the Rita Dinan Abbey Museum in Northwest Las Vegas, spaces for art exhibition are scattered throughout the Las Vegas Valley. Cooper Ross Studios is no different, except that it's located in the home of artists and art professionals Matthew Cooper and J.K. Russ. And it's showing the type of artwork that you don't see often in Las Vegas. Currently, Cooper's work is on display in the studio, and it's an homage to Ukrainian artist Kazimir Malevich, who made waves in 1915, debuting a new style of abstract art called suprematism. In a city often accused of culturally playing it safe, Cooper's exhibit introduces Las Vegas to a pivotal figure and movement of the avant-garde. State of Nevada senior producer Mike Pravat spoke to Cooper earlier this week, and here's how it went.
Matthew, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be at Nevada Public Radio.
I want to begin by going back a few decades. You first saw Malevich's work in New Zealand in 1998. Why did it strike such a chord with you back then?
Well, I was very young and impressionable, and I was at art school. I guess I was about 20 years old. And having known his work from art history and seeing it in books, I thought it was very graphic and very straightforward, like some squares on a white canvas. But when I saw them in the flesh and saw how kind of grungy and dirty they were, and there was like pencil marks all over the canvas and there was corrections in the paint, it really got me excited about the actual painterliness of how abstract art can be.
And what brought you back to him to the extent that you began recreating the works of his suprematist era?
I think that started probably in 2020 during COVID. I got a chance to go over to Amsterdam to work, and I got to go to the Stedelijk, where there's a big collection of his works. And I got to see that painting again that I saw in New Zealand 30-odd years ago. I kind of felt like I needed to get to the bottom of what I was interested in. Like as you get older, you kind of sort of think, oh, I've got to grow up a bit and work out what these things are that intrigue me so much.
The name of this exhibit is 110, a super century of Malevich's suprematism. And it's the third exhibit of yours in nearly 2 years that includes these recreations, most of which are fairly small paintings, but they are not copies per se of his works. Explain to us how you remade them.
It's always tricky trying to describe art on the radio, right?
Of course.
What you see in the exhibition, 50 paintings, and a lot of them are, as you say, quite small, painted on paper, and they have different color backdrops, gold leaf, silver leaf, purple, teal. And on top of those backdrops are pieces of wood, painted wood with wood grain. And then the wood is pierced with nails. And so the images come from compositions that Kazimir Malevich designed from 1915 to 1920. And I've been reproducing those, but I'm making them instead of just shapes, basic shapes, squares, rectangles, circles. I'm turning them into dimensional forms, so pieces of wood, lumber, and then using the nails to kind of fix them in place. So it's kind of saying that these images have already been done by Malevich, but I'm kind of putting my own spin on it.
You frequently incorporate Las Vegas into your work, though not typically in obvious ways. What's the connection of the city to the current exhibit?
Right. Yeah, I'm always thinking about it sort of through the lens of Las Vegas. It's kind of one of the reasons why we decided to come to Las Vegas and make art, because it's ultimately a aesthetic place. It's designed, it's abstracted, there's lots of different forms that are basically there to lure you in. Because Malevich's work was some of the first consistently abstract or non-objective paintings ever made, I kind of feel like there's an interest between, say, the spectacle of the Strip and the utopianism of Malevich's work. And so there's a gray area in between there that I think both of them kind of overlap. I'm still not 100% sure what it is, and perhaps that's why I'm doing these works.
In the notes for this exhibit, you note that the aesthetic of the Strip can be considered abstract. What do you mean by that?
if you kind of dig down into how some of the casinos are developed and a lot of the aesthetics of the casinos that are developed, they came from think tanks in the, I think, 80s and 90s. And a lot of those think tanks were put together to manipulate the senses. So, you know, of course, there's the olfactory sensation that we experience in all casinos, whether it's El Cortez or Aria, but also the visual stimulation and what's called auto-evacuee, you know, that kind of fear of a vacuum, and the intensity of all these things kind of not assaulting you, but kind of manipulating you, let's say.
Matthew, I want to shift from the works on display to the space hosting them. You opened Cooper Russ in March 2022 after investigating spaces elsewhere. Why did you forego a more public location and settle on renovating your private space for it?
I think a lot of it was perhaps just financial. I mean, having spent 15 years in Las Vegas and watching ebbs and flows of the art scene, burnout seems to be a common problem. And thinking kind of conceptually about how Las Vegas as a greater whole is constructed, that it's generally privately owned and people have quite private lives, I thought it was quite a nice way to incorporate art as kind of a private event that people elect to come and see. It means that people have to make an appointment, but it also means that people have more conversation rather than just, say, walking into a store and being asked, you know, do you have any questions, you know. People come understanding perhaps what we're about, what the exhibition's about, or they know people in the exhibitions. I guess it pushes past all the kind of uncomfortable starting meeting things, you know. We get to just get straight into talking about art.
And what's been the response to that? Is it aligning with the goals that you and your wife have had for the gallery?
It is. We're happy just to kind of slowly build it and really focus on people that want to be there.
Have there been any disadvantages to having the space in your home as opposed to having a more public space?
If we could clone ourselves, it would be great to have perhaps a larger space or a space that's open more frequently. At this point, we're running our own sort of arts logistics business, and we're also trying to continue our practice, and we travel quite a bit. It kind of suits our temperament and our timetable.
You have 2 to 5 different exhibitions a year at Cooper Russ. Aside from the one showing now, what kinds of exhibits have you been showing there, and whose work do you tend to show?
We kind of started thinking about sharing our collection. We've got a reasonably large collection of international art. And so my partner, J.K. Russ, we sit down and we talk about ideas that we want to explore within the Las Vegas context. So we take works from our collection and we use those as kind of the seed ideas to build the exhibition around. And then we supplement it with other artists that we're interested in Las Vegas that we feel are saying something about either the aesthetics or the philosophy or psychology of being in Las Vegas. And then we also look further afield at other artists who are interested in the aesthetics that we're interested in. So we're starting to bring in more international artists, and it also, I think, helps align Las Vegas with the rest of the functioning art world. It kind of shows that the work being produced here is of interest and is saying interesting things.
Now, you're not done with Malevich. You're on your 190th creation currently in preparation for the 4th Malevich-inspired exhibit. Is the goal to reimagine all 687 of his suprematist works?
When I started this idea, I obviously didn't know enough about Malevich's suprematist period, thinking that I'd seen probably 10 paintings in the flesh and thinking maybe there were 50. And having found a rare copy of the catalogue Raisonné and then looking at the suprematist period and realizing that there were, you know, almost 700, I kind of thought I've bitten off more than I can chew. It's been an interesting process to go through and use such a pared-down group of forms. Usually, if I get bored with something, I just stop and move on to something else. Mm. I'm in the almost hitting 200 works, and they're still providing me with interesting ideas of composition and color and scale, all the things that artists kind of get nerdy about.
When you hit 687, how do you think you'll feel?
I don't know. That's what I'm excited about. You know, after reading a lot of his theoretical works that he wrote when he was teaching in Kyiv, I kind of felt like there's something more to it as well that perhaps maybe only artists can discover. And so that's why I'm physically remaking them. But yeah, it is very much kind of an in utero idea at this point. And so it's odd when people come and see the exhibition, because even though it's presented as a finished form of 50 paintings, for me it's very much just a little drop in the bucket of what I'm, I guess, trying to achieve. It's a bit of a carrot on the end of a stick idea.
Matthew Cooper is an artist and a co-owner of Cooper Russ Studios, which includes a gallery that's showing 110, a supercentury of Malevich's suprematism, through January 18th, and we'll have a link about it on knpr.org. Matthew, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Mike.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
So things are winding down as the year ends, and this rings true for some of the cultural institutions. What's UNLV doing to close out the fall semester?
Well, one thing they're doing is hosting a guitar masterclass at the Lee and Thomas Beam Music Center on December 11th, and it's being performed by a familiar face. The Columbia-born Richard Kobo is a local, and he's a former UNLV professor, and he's returning to campus with a show called Diary of Musical Images.
Diary of Musical Images. Do those three nouns go together?
They do here. It's the concept of his brand new show, which will highlight his Latin-fluenced take on classical guitar, and I suspect be of a more personal nature. This is one of four guitar-based concerts in UNLV's Performing Arts Center season. They had Jason Vio in October, and in February and March, they see Montreal Guitar Trio and Sergio and Oder Assad, respectively. If you love classical and international guitar, UNLV has you covered. And folks, this December 11th concert is under $40, so this is an affordable entry point for any classical guitar newbies out there.
Sounds like a deal. From UNLV, we go to the Mob Museum. What's happening there?
One thing I've noticed is that the Mob Museum programmers must love to drink. Or maybe it's just them pleasing their members and patrons who love to drink. Either way, they've got a distillery and a speakeasy over there. And then there's this happening also on December 11th. The event is called Cocktails, Organized Crime, and Classic Cinema with Eddie Mueller.
Why do I know that name?
He is a host on Turner Classic Movies, and he's also known as the so-called Czar of Noir. And for those of you in the dark at the moment, film noir is a crime drama genre offshoot that focuses on the, we'll call it, dark underbelly of society. Some examples of this are movies like Double Indemnity, The Big Sleep, Touch of Evil, and a good chunk of Alfred Hitchcock's middle-era filmography.
You said there'd be drinking.
Yes, yes. Mueller's obvious contribution to the event is his introduction and curation of classic movie clips that include some element of organized crime. However, he is also making cocktails that will be themed to the night's film programming, which means you got to be 21 for this one. And this happens again on December 11th.
Got it on the calendar. Finally, we have to mention something that's holiday related. We recently discussed a few alternative takes on A Christmas Carol, so let's do the same thing for The Nutcracker.
The Nutcracker is that other Christmas stage classic. Traditionally, Nevada Ballet Theater's take in Las Vegas and that of Reno Dance Companies have been the decades-long go-tos for this Tchaikovsky Fantasia. However, here's two other versions to consider. over at the Smith Center in Las Vegas on December 16th. The Jazz Vegas Orchestra Big Band will once again perform Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn's interpretation of The Nutcracker, along with a few other holiday classics. And what's interesting is the Smith Center's website, they have this cool little anecdote about this version of The Nutcracker. Apparently, Ellington and Strayhorn were performing residence in Vegas in 1960, and at the same time, Ellington was being courted by Columbia Records. And the label was like, hey, if you want to sign with us, you can record anything you want. And this is the idea that Ellington came up with. A suite of music from The Nutcracker played as jazz music. And how rad is that?
Sure, but there is another version of The Nutcracker, right?
Yes, The Buttcracker. Specifically, Buttcracker Neverland. As you know, this being up in your neck of the woods at the Baruca Theater in Reno, this takes place through December 21st. And it's a good-natured send-up of not just The Nutcracker, but, at least for this year's run, also Peter Pan and Dancing with the Stars, because why not? And when I say this year's run, this is the 14th year that The Buttcracker has been produced. So this is also tradition.
Gotta love a strong Reno tradition. That's all the time we have for this week. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.